Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming out on this late fall morning. Of course, we have some announcements. Holy Mother's Helping Hands is our food and clothing drive for the less fortunate. We're 2 months into that drive, and it will end at the end of December. But we will be giving, they were scheduled to pick up the food that's already been offered this past week, but somehow or another, I guess after their Thanksgiving rush, it was a little bit much for them to come and get them. But they will come and get them next week, and we have new boxes to put out. So if you're inclined to offer some food or clothing, the list of what's needed is on a flyer that's next to the box there out in the foyer. And that, please be mindful of that list, because we can't give them the other things. We have to separate those and give them to another homeless shelter. So if you're going to help the food bank and help us meet our goal of 500 pounds of food, that's the list that we need to abide by. We also are trying to raise $1,800 in cash donations. We're well along in that department, so if you feel so disposed, you can find the link on our website. It's also in your e-news each week, just to click, and you just go right to the donation page. So those of you who have participated already, thank you very much. And those who are yet to participate, we look forward to your help with meeting our goals. It's always good to share our bounty. The way the universe works is that when we share our bounty, we're likely to come into some bounty ourselves, if you want to think about it that way. And thinking about things that give us reason to give thanks, to be grateful, our celebration of Thanksgiving last Thursday week, was well attended. 18 of us gave thanks together, then enjoyed a potluck feast and one another's company in the monastery's fellowship hall. Thanks to all who came. And next year, if you find yourself at loose ends for where to spend Thanksgiving, I think you'll enjoy it with us. We also had a full helping of instruction on karma yoga from Swami Atmarupanandaji when he was with us over the Thanksgiving weekend. Ravi Ponangi, many of you know Ravi, kindly made a video of the Swami's Sunday talk. That's already up on our website. Our webmistress Cindy has been busy with the aftercare from her mother's surgery, but will have the downloadable audio recordings of both the Swami's Saturday retreat and Sunday talk on the site website later this week. Many of you already know, but if you don't, this is very pleasing news. Swami Sarvadevanandaji, our head minister, will be with us from Thursday, December 20th to Saturday, the 22nd. He will speak at the Global Mall that Thursday evening, the 20th, at 6:30 p.m. His topic is the relevance of Swami Vivekananda to us right now. The Swami also will give talks here in the chapel on Friday evening at 7 p.m. and on Saturday morning at 11 a.m. On Friday evening after the Swami's talk, we'll have a potluck supper and reception for him, and then on Saturday after he gives his 11 a.m. talk, very quickly thereafter he has to leave for the airport. So any of you who want private spiritual instruction from the Swami will need to see him on Friday, or probably on Friday. So any of you want private spiritual instruction from the Swami, please let me know by email right away so that that can be scheduled. I'll just make a quick note, too, for those of you who mark your calendars. Holy Mother's birthday celebration, her puja, will be held this year on December the 30th. December 30th. And we'll also, of course, have our Christmas Eve service on December 24th in the evening. Have I not mentioned something that should be mentioned as an announcement? Anyone have anything? All right. Well, we'll start with our regular chant that explains our relationship to the divine and our purpose here. I'll remind you that this translation is by our beloved Swami Yogeshananda, the founder of this center. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvina Vaditamastu, Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. May the Divine Being look over us lovingly as a mother and father. May the Divine Being support and nourish us as a mother and father. May we have the strength and skill to study together the art of spirituality. May no misunderstandings arise amongst us. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Peace, peace, peace be unto us and to all beings everywhere. So I have a song this morning. It's relevant to what we're our topic today. Many of you already know, I'm sure, that the symbolism of Jacob's ladder in the biblical telling of Jacob and his encounter with the angels, the ladder is the spine. The spine is Jacob's ladder is our spine. So I will sing this song this morning, as you will see as we go on. It's relevant to the topic today. We are climbing Jacob's ladder. We are climbing Jacob's ladder. We are climbing Jacob's ladder, children of her love. Every rung goes higher, higher. Every rung goes higher, higher. Every rung goes higher, higher. Children of her love. Children, do you want your freedom? Children, do you want your freedom? Children, do you want your freedom? Children of her love. Keep on climbing, you will make it. Keep on climbing, you will make it. Keep on climbing, you will make it. Children of her love. She is waiting to take your hand, yes. She is waiting to take your hand, yes. She is waiting to take your hand, children of her love. We are climbing Jacob's ladder. We are climbing Jacob's ladder. We are climbing Jacob's ladder, children of his love. Every rung goes higher, higher. Every rung goes higher, higher. Every rung goes higher, higher. Children of his love. Children, do you want your freedom? Children, do you want your freedom? Children, do you want your freedom? Children of his love. Keep on climbing, you will make it. Keep on climbing, you will make it. Keep on climbing, you will make it. Children of his love. He is waiting to take your hand, yes. He is waiting to take your hand, yes. He is waiting to take your hand, children of his love. Children of her love. Children of their love. Om Amen. Again, welcome. Welcome to you all. Thanks for coming out this morning. The topic today is, what can you expect from meditation? What can you expect from meditation? December is a month for the study of Raja Yoga, a spiritual path often called the yoga of meditation. As a Raja Yogi, you use ancient proven spiritual techniques to quiet your mind and gain control of your attention. Regular daily practice of Raja Yoga increases your ability to concentrate and may lead to meditation. This can unite you with the divine presence, the source of your being, and liberate you from the cycle of rebirth and death. And contained in that statement are the two meanings of yoga. Unite you with the divine presence. Yoga means to unite. It also means detachment. It can liberate you, detach you from that which causes the cycle of rebirth and death. Sri Ramakrishna said, "It is God's will that we should run about a little. Then it is great fun." Sri Ramakrishna said, "It is God's will that we should run about a little. Then it is great fun. God has created the world in play, as it were. This is called Mahamaya, the great illusion. Therefore, one must take refuge in the Divine Mother, the cosmic power itself. It is she who has bound us with the shackles of illusion. The realization of God is impossible only by those whose shackles are broken." The Master continued, "Therefore, one must propitiate the Divine Mother, the primal energy, in order to obtain God's grace. God himself is Mahamaya, who deludes this world with her illusion and conjures up the magic of creation, preservation, and destruction. She has spread this veil of ignorance before your eyes. But let me say, as you've heard it said a number of times here, Tattvamasi, that thou art. You are the divine presence that has created this illusion in play. The cosmic mind, according to the Chandogya Upanishad, said, 'I am one, I shall become many. I am one, I shall become many.' And so the dream of creation began. You are that dreamer. As Swami Vivekananda said, we are infinite dreamers, dreaming finite dreams." So it is not that this is something being done to us. We are that is doing this. And when we are weary of it, it can end. We are that power that is creating, preserving, and destroying. And when it is time for us to destroy the illusion, we can do so. That's what we're going to talk about this morning. As Sri Ramakrishna said to some gentleman who came to see him from Calcutta and asked the question, "Well, why should we not enjoy the world?" Sri Ramakrishna said, "Go, enjoy the world. I have no objection. But when you are sick of it, return to me. I have the cure." So Sri Ramakrishna goes on, "We can go into the inner chamber only when she lets us pass through the door. Living outside, we see only outer objects, but not that eternal being, existence, knowledge, bliss, absolute. She alone is the root of the universe. That primal energy has two aspects, vidya and avidya. Avidya deludes. Avidya conjures up lust and greed, which casts the spell of worldly desires. Vidya begets devotion, kindness, wisdom and love, which lead one to God. For those of you who want to find that passage, it's from the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, chapter 4, Advice to Householders. The date on which he said that was August 13th, 1882, just almost exactly 4 years before his passing away. So it was the culmination of his wisdom. As I pointed out, the game is being played because we want it to be played. The great Roman poet and mystic Marcus Aurelius said, and notice how he degenderfied this, it loves to happen. It loves to happen. We love to happen. We love to live. Our only problem is that we get entangled in it. Instead of just seeing it as a game, I come and go from the game. As Krishna describes it in chapter 2 of the Gita. You just come and go. You take a garment, you leave a garment. We come and go from the game, but we get entangled. And the entanglement is an aspect of our minds, this entanglement. And so, what do? We learn to control our mind. That's how this relates, all of what I just read, relates to what you can expect from meditation. That's how it relates to what you can expect from meditation. Here's the great open secret. The practice of meditation slowly and slowly erodes the power of avidya's delusion and allows you to awaken from its spell. As it's said in Breaker of the World, This World's Chain, the evening hymn we recite each evening, let us look deep in thine eyes. Let us look deep in thine eyes. There is the power to awake us from Maya's spell. Remembering always that the divine presence we are seeking, and into whose eyes we wish to look, is us. As Swami Prabhavananda said in his first instruction for meditation, the chosen ideal, that aspect of God that appeals most deeply to your heart, the chosen ideal is you yourself. Learn to feel that living presence. The other three instructions were patience, perseverance, and expectation. Expectation that at any moment we'll break through the veil of illusion. We will sufficiently awaken. And here's the other side. It dispels the illusion, meditation does, slowly and slowly. Meditation also spontaneously and automatically gives rise to the vidya that begets devotion, kindness, wisdom, and love, which can lead you to God. That's reprising that quote from Sri Ramakrishna. Meditation spontaneously and automatically gives rise to the vidya that begets devotion, kindness, wisdom, and love, which leads you to God. Why? Because meditation stills the thought waves of the mind and allows your true original nature to manifest and be seen. And seen is very critical here. Vidya and avidya are from the root vid, to see. In English, video, vision, the noun for seeing in Latin is video, seeing. So meditation dispels our illusion by clarifying our vision, of the outside world, we see more clearly what it is that we are entangled with, and therefore are able to release our entanglement. And then it allows us to see more clearly inside, see that divine presence, feel that divine presence. Some of us see it, some of us feel it. Each of us is unique. Your experience as you go forward with meditation will be unique. It'll have common characteristics, but it will be unique. So let's just start with the technical aspects here. According to an online medical dictionary, this is a quote, meditation is a practice of concentrated focus upon a sound, object, visualization, the breath, movement, or attention itself in order to increase awareness of the present moment, reduce stress, promote relaxation, and enhance personal and spiritual growth. Yes to all of that. Can you imagine if you learn to concentrate more, if you learn to master concentration, how much easier things become for you? If you are a master of concentration, a master of contemplation and concentration, what's contemplation? Looking at something clearly, just gazing on it, saying, what is this? Clear vision, vidya. Looking at it and seeing it clearly, contemplating it, and then concentrating. When your ability to contemplate and concentrate is strong, everything in the world becomes easier for you. Therefore, it reduces stress, promotes relaxation. Of course, this is one of the things, if those of you who go back far enough to remember the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi talking about meditation. These were one of the things that he stressed. It'll reduce your life stress. It'll promote relaxation and enhance personal and spiritual growth. As Krishna puts it in the Gita, you become more efficient as a human being. You become more efficient. Yet, for the purposes of Patanjali's Raja Yoga, meditation has a very specific definition and a particular objective: to still the thought waves in the mind. That's the long-range goal. There's eight steps, eight limbs of yoga. We won't go into those this morning, but there's eight limbs of yoga that are a step-by-step process, but something that you practice simultaneously. Start with one step, and then you add the second step while continuing to practice the first, and so on and so forth, until you're ultimately practicing the first six altogether. And then he says, that's the end of self-effort. Seven and eight are something that happens to you. And the seven and eight steps, seven and eight limbs, are samadhi and liberation, or within the Raja Yoga context, kaivalya, which means independence, not being dependent on anything, not having any limitation. This is what happens when we learn to still the thought more waves of the mind. This morning, we will discuss meditation's practical benefits as listed by the medical dictionary, review what Patanjali means by meditation, and explore Swami Vivekananda's explanation of what happens when we succeed at the practice of Raja Yoga. Practical benefits. There are many different methods of meditation. The Ramakrishna lineage tends to emphasize mantra meditation. So when we receive initiation, we receive mantra diksha. We're given instructions on how to think about what we're doing when we practice meditation, and we're given a mantra. Why this mantra? As Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, various are thy names, O Lord. In each and every name thy power resides. What does it mean, thy power resides? Swami Vivekananda says, there is no difference between the mantra, and the divinity that it represents. It is, in Sanskrit, Shabda Brahman, Brahman in the form of sound. And so when you are in the presence of that mantra, when that mantra is recurring within you, that is the, you are in the presence, you are manifesting the presence of the divine. The divine's power is without limit. It can dispel your avidya and reveal that which is revealed by vidya, clear seeing. So this is why mantra meditation is emphasized by the Ramakrishna lineage. Sri Ramakrishna himself said it was the best method for this time. But there are many different forms. Each is a practice of concentrated focus. I mentioned mantra meditation, sound, object, a picture or effigy or icon, We have them here. They are there not just because it's nice, not just decoration. They, too, each of those pictures is the living presence. There is no difference. We're told by the Swamis, we're told by the great teachers, there's no difference between the image of Balaji. If you've ever been in a Balaji temple, you'll know that that image is very powerful. It has great power. You feel it. The power coming from here is perhaps more subtle, but no less. So each of these, if you choose to practice meditation by returning your attention again and again to an image or an icon or an effigy, that works also. Visualization of a spiritual ideal, if you are devotionally inclined, visualization of a spiritual ideal within yourself, whatever your Ishta Devata is, your chosen ideal is, or if you are agyani, those who are not inclined toward the devotional approach, you may visualize the sky, and this is very powerful. Or an endless ocean of consciousness. The idea is the unlimitedness, the identification of what you are thinking of, what you are contemplating and concentrating on, and unlimitedness. Movement. We know of the Sufis and their special way of dancing, circling, and so on. I've not done it, so I can't speak to that. But I know people who have, and they say it does release you from your worldly thoughts and take you into an ecstatic state. So that movement is also a way of meditating. Or focusing on attention itself. This is a combination in Vipassana meditation, practiced primarily, not exclusively, but primarily by Buddhists, of starting with the focusing attention on the breath, and then as you sink into the silence, you become aware of things arising and passing away, arising and passing away. And so you're focusing on the attention itself, that you're seeing this happening, but having no identification with it. Very powerful. We do these things in order to what? Increase awareness of the present moment. Robert Frost's shortest poem. We dance around in a ring and suppose the secret sits in the middle and knows. We dance around in a ring and suppose the secret sits in the middle and knows. That present moment is that secret that sits in the middle. When we are present to just this moment, you become hyper-conscious, super-conscious. Your awareness expands. Why? Because it's not entangled with anything else from any other moment. Nothing from the future, nothing from the past. You become aware that your consciousness is much, much bigger than you knew. It's called hyperconsciousness or superconsciousness by Swami Vivekananda and others who write about it. And of course, when you're in that state, it reduces stress. There's nothing to be stressed about. You're in that precious present moment. Nothing to be stressed about. It promotes relaxation. You'll feel your face. Literally, the mask that we make of our face in when you begin to seriously enter into meditation, you'll feel your face relax and your whole body becomes, as it were, one solid thing. You don't distinguish between one part and another. It's very interesting. And of course, as we do this and we explore within, this enhances our personal and spiritual growth. So that's the practical aspects of that. Now, if any of you have questions about that, please hold them, because we'll want to answer them at the end. There are almost always some questions about the practical aspects. Just hold them and we will answer them at the end. But now we'll go on to Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, which Swami Vivekananda translated and commented on in his book Raja Yoga, and Swami Prabhavananda translated and commented on using sourcing also Vivekananda's translation and commentary in his book How to Know God. We sell both of those books here. I cannot recommend them highly enough. They really will give you great and detailed instruction. It's good, if you can, to read them together. In Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, there are specific definitions of concentration and meditation. Concentration equals 12 seconds of uninterrupted attention. If you can hold your attention for 12 seconds on something, you've achieved concentration. Now, Swami Vivekananda said, anyone who can cook well or anyone who can play a musical instrument well can meditate, because they have mastered the ability to concentrate for that length of time and organize activities one after another through their process of concentration and knowing what to do, both cooking, that's one way of looking at it, or playing a musical instrument. So concentration, 12 seconds. An image that's often used is pouring oil from one vessel to another. That nice, smooth, unbroken stream of oil from one vessel to another. Sustain that for 12 seconds, you've achieved concentration. Meditation equals 2.5 minutes of uninterrupted concentration. 2.5 minutes, 144 seconds of uninterrupted concentration. This is why we say we practice meditation. Most people say, I meditate. Well, if they're going to be accurate, they would say, I practice meditation, because it's not so easy to sustain your attention and your concentration continuously for 2.5 minutes. You'll find that if you work at it for some years, you will achieve it. The objective of all this effort is first to make continuous and then to still the thought waves in the mind. Now, this is why mantra meditation is so heavily emphasized in the Ramakrishna lineage. It's because it's relatively easy to repeat a mantra over and over continuously. It is a thought, it is sound, Shabda Brahman, filled with the power of the divine, so it becomes self-sustaining after a while. You'll find it's occurring in your mind even when you hadn't thought to do it. But this is why mantra meditation is emphasized. So to make the thought waves continuous, same thought wave over and over and over and over and over and over for 12 seconds, 144 seconds. Ultimately then to still the thought waves in the mind. And Patanjali describes this as a sequence of activities where the concentration becomes greater and greater, and there becomes just one great thought. And finally, that one great thought forces everything else to the periphery, and there is only that one great thought continuously, and there are no other thoughts. And then that thought itself, as you find, merges into the divine presence, which is what Jesus was speaking of when he said, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God." That's exactly what he was speaking of. Purity of heart allows the mind to be still. So first, the first objective is to make the thoughts continuous and then to still the thought waves in the mind. And when this happens, and this is, you can read this in Swami Vivekananda's Introduction to Raja Yoga, when this happens, your universe of name and form are made by the activities of our thought waves in the mind, the vrittis and the citta, to use the Sanskrit terms, your universe of name and form disappears and is replaced by a state called samadhi, which leads to realization, self-realization, liberation, or kaivalya, depends on how you want to think about it or talk about it. So that's the sequence. And as I said, in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, there is a step-by-step development of the capacity to do this. But in brief, here is Swami Vivekananda's explanation. And until I say otherwise, this is a quote. Swami Vivekananda's explanation. The science of Raja Yoga proposes to give us a means of observing the internal states. The instrument is the mind itself. The power of attention, when properly guided and directed toward the internal world, will analyze the mind and illumine facts for us. The powers of the mind are like rays of light dissipated. Let me repeat that. As we sit here, for most of us, and I raise my hand as well, the powers of the mind are like the rays of light dissipated. When they are concentrated, they illumine. This is our only means of knowledge. Now, all of us know about using a little magnifying glass to concentrate the rays of the sun. Essentially, that's what you're doing when you practice concentration, is you're pulling those rays together and focusing them on those things that were mentioned before as processes or possibilities for meditation. This is our only means of knowledge, and that's why most of us remain ignorant, so ignorant. It's not that we're bad. It's not that we're wrong. It's simply that we have not learned to concentrate our attention so that we overcome our ignorance. Back to the quote. Everyone is using it, both the external and the internal world, but for the psychologist, the same minute observation has to be directed to the internal world, which the scientific man directs to the external. And this requires a great deal of practice. Now, by psychologist, he means you or me practicing meditation. We become our own psychologist. Everyone is using concentration, both in the external and in the internal world, but for the psychologist, the same minute observation has to be directed toward the internal world, which the scientific man directs to the external. And this requires a great deal of practice. Now he explains why it takes such a great deal of practice. And so listen very intently. This just needs to be ingrained in us. This is why it's so difficult for us. From our childhood upwards, we have been taught only to pay attention to things external, but never to things internal. Hence, most of us have nearly lost the faculty of observing the internal mechanism. From our childhood upwards, we have been taught only to pay attention to things external, but never to things internal. Hence, most of us have nearly lost the faculty of observing the internal mechanism. To turn the mind, as it were, inside, stop it from going outside, and then to concentrate all its powers and throw them upon the mind itself in order that it may know its own nature, analyze itself, is very hard work. Yet that is the only way to anything which will be a scientific approach to the subject. What is the use of such knowledge? In the first place, knowledge itself is the highest reward of knowledge. And secondly, there is also utility in it. And this is such a sweet understatement. There's utility in it. Because he follows that by saying, it will take away all our misery. It will take away all our misery. When by analyzing his own mind, man comes face to face, as it were, with something which is never destroyed, something which is by its own nature eternally a pure and perfect, he will be no more miserable, no more unhappy. All misery comes from fear, from unsatisfied desire. Man finds that he will never die, and then he will have no more fear of death. All misery comes from fear, from unsatisfied desire. Man will find that he never dies, and then he will have no more fear of death. When he knows that he is perfect, he will have no more vain desires, and both these causes being absent, there will be no more misery. There will be perfect bliss, even while in this body. For those of you who want to go look this up, this quote will be online by Wednesday of next week, this coming week, I mean, Wednesday or Thursday. But for those of you who want to go look this up, where this is embedded, it's from Chapter 1, from The Complete Works, Volume 1, Raja Yoga, Chapter 1, Introductory, or you can just get a copy of the book, and it's in the introduction. So, this is what you can expect from meditation. You can expect to be free of misery, free of fear, free of the fear of death, free of the fear of life. Life becomes far more enjoyable. What is more enjoyable than being in the company of those swamis who come here? Swami Yogatmananda, for those of you who have encountered him, Swami Sridharananda, Swami Kripamoyananda. They share that. They share that as a radiance that comes from them. It flows off them like light from a light bulb. So this is what, but it's not restricted to them. They've just practiced long enough to manifest it. Each one of us can do it. And the wondrous part of it is that it is self-fulfilling as you go along. Things get better and better and better and better. I mean decade by decade. I don't mean this week. yes, things will always get better for you a little this week and then worse for you the next week and so on and so forth. That's the way we experience life normally. But on this ascending curve, where we more and more understand that we are deathless, stand as a rock, Vivekananda said. Stand as a rock. You are indestructible. You are the Self, the God of the universe. When we have that as a conviction, what to fear? When we know that there is nothing, nothing, nothing for us to need or want, we are Purna. We are full. There are no more vain desires, no more agitation of the mind. As Swami Prabhupada would say, desire is nothing more than a restlessness of the mind, a restlessness of the mind. So when we're free of fear, when we're free of want, we are kaivalya, independent, needing nothing, wanting nothing, fearing nothing, accepting of everything. I'll just leave you with this final thought. I always like to have Vivekananda, when practical, give us the final word. This is a visualization for meditation by Vivekananda. Think of a space in your heart, and in the midst of that space, think that a flame is burning. Think of that flame as your own soul, and inside the flame is another effulgent light, and that is the soul of your soul, God. So now we have Swamiji's description of Atman, Brahman. Your soul, and within the soul, God. United, I and my Father are one, or as Sri Ramakrishna said, I and my Mother are one. Think of a space in your heart, and in the midst of that space, think that a flame is burning. Think of that flame as your own soul, and inside the flame is another effulgent light, and that is the soul of your soul, God. Jai Swamiji. So I asked you to hold your questions. Now's the time, this wonderful time, when we get to talk with one another and ask questions and make comments and share as a congregation. This is Sangha. This is the meaning of study together the art of spirituality. Anything? Somebody be bold. Yes, dear.
I have a little trouble understanding what is the chosen ideal, or how do you choose the ideal?
The ideal is that aspect of God that most appeals deeply to your heart. Usually when one takes initiation, mantra diksha, there will be a name associated with that mantra, and that will become, for the time being, your chosen ideal. You may find later that you want to expand that definition. In my own case, after perhaps 17 or 20 years, something like this, I went to Swami Swahananda and I said, Guruji, I'd like to add mother to my mantra. And he sat me down and he did it. He was not a man of great formality in those cases. So, so it's not a fixed thing. As you evolve and grow, it's said that you ultimately come to the point where the chosen ideal is no longer particularized, but it becomes the ocean of consciousness itself. Sri Ramakrishna said, through devotion, through the cooling power of devotion, in the ocean of consciousness, and he used the metaphor of an iceberg, blocks of ice form. These are the forms of the divine that are created, as I said in the very beginning. We are the ones doing this. So out of the ocean of consciousness, we create a form of the divine that we wish to be in communion with, one of the bhavas, one of the attitudes we take toward that aspect. As I said earlier about Balaji, Balaji was, of course, pre-existing. It's an aspect of the divine, illimitable, unnumbered aspects. But someone visualized Balaji. Someone saw that form and so created an image.
Ishta.
Yeah. Chosen. So this is, you may come to your own. As I said, the aspects of the divine are by definition, I mean, when you talk about infinite and illimitable, there can be no end to this. But you start with the guidance of a teacher, and he says, here, do this. This name is filled with power. This name is filled with the presence. So use that name. And as time goes on, your mind becomes your teacher, because of its purification, and you may find that you do it differently, completely spontaneously. Good question. Very good question. Anyone else?
Shankar?
Yes, dear.
You might want to mention that when you ask for initiation, you can request the mantra for your own chosen ideal, if you have one already.
Yes, that discussion is had with the person who's giving you initiation. But you can indeed, if you have a chosen ideal, Laurie is speaking from personal experience, you can ask for a mantra centered on that chosen ideal. Yes, thank you, Laurie. It's anything else?
Swamiji, you spoke about Raj Yoga, which I find to be extremely important in the sense of it's like connecting the dots.
Yes.
Out of four yogas, why is it called Raj Yoga? Royal yoga.
You cannot.
Because I think it is because of these spiritual disciplines that are interwoven.
You simply cannot really practice any of the other yogas
without
practicing meditation. Yes. In one form or another, the jnani's form of meditation is somewhat different than there's a great deal different from the bhakta's form of meditation. The karma yogi practices yet a different form of meditation that is really doesn't depend so much on the cushion so much. They may include that. But the karma yogi's meditation is a moment-to-moment meditation. Every action, every thought, every perception is regarded and analyzed and then offered, so that one frees oneself through karma yoga from attachment to either their actions or the results of those actions.
There are two points
yes.
that I wanted to emphasize. that because of these spiritual disciplines, Jnana Marga becomes not just indulgence in intellectual philosophy, but it brings it, you know, under that spiritual.
Well,
because otherwise it will become pure, you know,
Jnana Yoga, or the Jnana Marga, as you were saying, is anything but intellectual.
Continue. And karma without Rajyoga disciplines will degenerate into mere good without that purity of thought.
Mm-hmm.
So it acts as a police, as if, for each yoga to become pure in its own kind.
Yes.
That's one point.
Well, let's just, for those people who don't know the word, Raja means king. Raja Yoga is the king of yogas. That's why Swamiji titled his book that way.
And the second point, to me, meditation is, in a way, you mentioned that it's a self-disciplinary technique to purify your internal thoughts, your world. So that is why all these yama, niyamas, all these things are prerequisites of meditation.
Yes.
Once
well,
that happens,
not prerequisites. They're something that you do along with.
Right.
But you find that your meditation improves as you use the yamas and niyamas.
And as we say, mind and speech cannot reach thee, but without thee we cannot think nor speak.
Yes, but the thee isn't out there. It's right here.
So all this, what I'm trying to say is that Rajyoga forms the groundwork, the basis of all the yogas. And because there are spiritual disciplines, we need to principles which you must observe, and self-control.
Yes.
Self-discipline. When that is mastered, then perhaps meditation can lead us to that ultimate goal.
Well, the king orders the kingdom. Is it not so? Brings the kingdom into order, rules the kingdom. The kingdom of heaven is within. If there's a kingdom of heaven within, it follows that there's a king within. So this king of yogas orders, you're right, absolutely right. It gives structure to the rest. But never think that the other yogas can't be pursued independent of Raja Yoga. They can. It's just more difficult. It's just more difficult. Yes, dear?
I have another sort of technical, practical question on the meditation. So after one receives the initiation, during meditation, should the focus be on the name or the form associated with the name, or on the words of the mantra itself, or a combination?
If I'm not mistaken, when Swami Sarvadevananda, who is the one who offers initiation now for us here, he gives fairly detailed instructions. In the beginning, it's very important to follow those instructions as precisely as possible. And I don't know precisely what those instructions are, but they will suffice, I guarantee you. So you do that. Then after a time, you find that your mind inclines more toward this or more toward that, more towards concentrating on the form, more than on concentrating on the sound of the words, more on concentrating on how you're counting them, either by a mala or on your fingers. So it individuates, because each of us is unique, it will individuate that way. But in the beginning, it's very important to follow the instructions carefully, just as they were given, and do it just as they were given. There's a reason for it. We have common challenges. And the instructions of the gurus are to help us overcome our common challenges. Because once we get past the common challenges, then we begin to deal with our individual challenges. But the common challenges are, yes, dear.
I'm back at practicing concentration instead of meditation. So take it from where it comes. But for those of us who are having a hard time understanding bhakti yoga, I think about comparing it to the relationship that the mother has with the child.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the mother sees the child, immediately the connection is love.
Mm-hmm.
So the picture, the name, everything evokes love.
Yes. And this is true of bhakti yoga, and mantra meditation is normally associated with the bhakti yoga path. And so you will begin to feel, not immediately necessarily, but certainly in time, you will begin to feel a great love for the figure that is at for the Ishtadevata. Again, that form of love will be uniquely your own. The comment just made was mother to child, and child to mother. There are five bhavas, five attitudes that are recommended by Sri Ramakrishna. I won't go into them now, but if you want to talk to them, talk to me about them individually. There are five attitudes that that serve us. He said, choose one. And have that be a part of your relationship with your Ishtadevata, your chosen ideal. Good, very good. Thank you for bringing that up. That is absolutely it. And there needs to be an attitude of love at the heart of mantra yoga. It doesn't need to be, but it serves you better if there is. Yes, just here.
Shankar, would you mind just now talking about the bhavas, the different bhavas?
Okay. The first is called the Shanta Bhava, the attitude of contentment. I am with my chosen ideal. I am contented to be with my ideal. There's nothing expected of me. There's nothing expected of the ideal. We're just content with one another. The second is Dasya Bhava, the attitude of a servant. This is the most prevalent one recommended by the Ramakrishna lineage because it so nicely ties with karma yoga, which is recommended practice along with your mantra meditation or mantra practice. So the servant, I am a servant of the Lord. I am a servant of everyone because everyone is the Lord. As Sri Ramakrishna said, serve Jiva as Shiva. Serve Jiva as Shiva. Each one of us, Jiva. Each one of us, he says, also Shiva. So this Dasya Bhava is there. And now I'm not going to remember the Sanskrit, but this third is the attitude of child to parent.
Vatsalya.
Vatsalya Bhava, okay. And for those of you who want to know the Sanskrit, Vatsalya, V-A-T-S-A-L-Y-A, Vatsalya. The attitude of child toward parent is, of course, a very natural one. The fourth is a somewhat unusual one for us, though Sri Ramakrishna practiced it and showed the power of it, and that is the attitude of a parent toward the child. The Sanskrit for that is Anyone remember?
What did this ask me for that? Fourth one.
Fourth for the attitude of parent to child. Well, apparently no one else remembers either. So, but in any event, we understand parent to child. And of course, this is the great exemplar of this is Yashoda, the foster mother of Krishna. She wasn't his real mother. She was given to him to take care of because of some complicated political and nasty business. But she truly regarded him as her own. And nothing would stand in the way of Yashoda's devotion to the baby Krishna, and even when he grew up older. Sri Ramakrishna practiced this with a little image of Rama called Ramlala. And he, for some time, practiced this. He would feed Ramlala, bathe Ramlala, clothe Ramlala. Everything, this was during that period of his sadhana. It was just a remarkable episode in his life. He wept bitterly one time when he thought that some ill-cooked rice had been taken by Ramlala and had perhaps bruised his lip. I mean, this is the intensity of that bhava, that attitude. The fifth is the one of lover. Now, it's easy to get confused with this and all these tantra thoughts and all this business. No, think of Radha. Think of Radha in her relationship with Krishna in Vrindavan. Absolute one of ecstatic love, no thought of anything but her lover. She neglected her appearance. She neglected her clothing. Everything was just because she was just, everything reminded her of Krishna. Everything was Krishna, Krishna, Krishna. And it's, put anklets on my feet. I want to dance with my Krishna. Put anklets on my feet. I want to dance with my Lord. This was her only thought. So this is the highest bhava. This is the one exemplified by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu.
Mirabai
also. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was the one that Sri Ramakrishna pointed to. He said that in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the two were born together, Krishna and Radha, so that they could experience that union as one being in one body. All this is talked about in great detail, by the way, in the book, The Divine Play, The Master's Divine Play. It's in the bookshop. Or, if you want the earlier translation, that translation, The Divine Play, is by Swami Chetanananda. He's now the head of the St. Louis Center. The earlier translation, somewhat more cumbersome, but a little more detailed, is by Swami Sharadananda. He didn't write it in, I've forgotten who the translator was now. I don't think it was Nikhilananda, but in any event, it's there. You can find out for yourself. So these bhavas are expounded in detail in The Great Master or The Divine Play. But those are the five attitudes. The one of contentment, peace, shanta bhava. The one of child. Oh, I'm sorry, the one of servant. So in ascending order, so to speak. The one of contentment, the one of servant, the one of child, the one of parent, and the one of lover. So those are the five attitudes or bhavas as recommended by Sri Ramakrishna. And he said that it is best for us as we practice our spiritual disciplines to choose one of those bhavas, to choose one of those attitudes and make that the framework make that the mental framework for our relationship with the divine, with our chosen ideal. It's easy to combine the servant and child relationship, by the way. You see yourself as a servant to your parent. There's a beautiful, beautiful evocation of this in Swamiji's book, Karma Yoga. He tells the story of a butcher who had attained total realization by being a servant to his parents. He was the child of his parents, but he was also their servant. Beautiful story.